It's difficult for us to imagine the profoundly innovative nature of this method, which relied heavily on reason. Philosophy, before Socrates, had had little or nothing to do with reason. The pre-Socratics were for the most part more interested in such topics as being, the metaphysical nature of what it means to be alive, or the ultimate nature of the world itself, speculating that it might be composed of water, or atoms. A few of these wild and woolly intuitions were uncannily accurate, given the way they were arrived at. But it was Socrates who realized that philosophy couldn't go on like this. Philosophers were already a laughing stock, but there was no reason why philosophy itself should be relegated to this category. If philosophical thought was to stop itself from becoming an intellectual joke, or slipping back into religious speculation from which it had emerged, it needed a more rigorous approach. This was supplied by Socrates' dialectal method. With the benefit of well over 2,000 years of hindsight, we can now see this as the forerunner of logic, which was to be invented by Plato's pupil Aristotle a century or so later. Socrates' achievement, and his pupil Plato's understanding of this, marked a crucial stage in the evolution of philosophy. To appreciate the full extent of this advance, one need only imagine a serious intellectual discussion devoid of reason. Yet, despite having found his true métier, Plato was still tempted to become a backslider and enter politics. Fortunately, he was dissuaded by the behavior of Athenian politicians. When the 30 tyrants took over after the Peloponnesian War, two of their leaders, Critias and Charmides, were close relatives. The reign of terror that followed might have inspired a young Stalin or Machiavelli, but it didn't impress Plato. After the Democrats took over, Plato's beloved teacher was tried on trumped-up charges of impiety and corrupting youth, and sentenced to death. In Plato's eyes, democracy was now tarred with the same brush as tyranny. Plato's close association with Socrates placed him in a dangerous position, and he was forced to remove himself from Athens for his own good. Thus began his travels, which were to last for the next 12 years. After learning all he could at the feet of his master, he would now learn from the world. But the world wasn't that large in those days, and for the first period of his exile, Plato studied just 20 miles away in the neighbouring territory of Megara, with his friend Euclid. This was not the famous geometer, but a former pupil of Socrates who had become renowned for the subtlety of his dialectic. Euclid had so loved Socrates that he had travelled through enemy Athenian territory disguised as a woman, to be present at the death of his master. Plato stayed with Euclid in Megara for 3 years, then journeyed to Cyrene in North Africa to study with the mathematician Theodorus. After this, he seems to have travelled on to Egypt. According to one persistent story, he now wished to visit some Magi in the Levant, and ended up travelling east as far as the banks of the Ganges. But this seems unlikely. Possibly during his stay in Megara, or during a stop on his travels, Plato wrote his earliest extant works. These are in the form of dialogues, and are heavily influenced by Socrates, both personally and intellectually. Yet Plato was not completely in his shadow. These dialogues are the creation of a consummate mind, great works of literature as well as philosophy. In many of them, Socrates makes an appearance as a leading character and puts forward his ideas. He comes across as infuriating, brilliant, but ultimately endearing, a complex blend of the buffoon and the saint. No less than 3 of Plato's early dialogues, the Apology, Crito, and Euthyphron, as well as the later Phaedo, are devoted to the trial, prison days, and ultimate death of Socrates. These events had a profound effect on Plato, and his description of them ranks alongside Hamlet and Dante's Inferno in Western literature. The Apology describes Socrates' trial and the 70-year-old philosopher's defense of himself before the people of Athens. As a legal or even a convincing defense, this is flimsy, to say the least. Socrates treated the charge with the contempt it deserved, and moved on to more interesting topics, such as why he was considered to be wise. He maintained that he was merely living up to the role proclaimed for him by the Delphic oracle, which had described him as the wisest man on earth. At first he had been suspicious of this pronouncement, as he knew nothing, a typical Socratic claim. So he had begun questioning others reputed to be wise, and discovered that in truth they knew nothing too. This is a classic example of the dialectic method, philosophy being used to reduce contemporary thinking to ruins. It bears a curious resemblance to Wittgenstein's linguistic analysis in modern-day philosophy. Indeed, what Socrates taught was not so much a philosophy as philosophic method, clear thinking. This he saw as not only a means to arriving at the truth, but also a way to good behavior. He would certainly have concurred with Wittgenstein's 20th-century claim, philosophy is not a theory, but an activity. Such an attitude leaves an essential vacuum at the heart of philosophic thinking. After Socrates, this was to be filled by Plato. After more than a decade of travelling, Plato arrived in Sicily, where he visited the crater of Mount Etna. This was a great tourist attraction of the period, and not just as a geographical phenomenon. This, people believed, was what the underworld looked like, and a visit to Etna thus afforded an instructive glimpse of future living conditions. But the crater held an even greater attraction for Plato, owing to its association with Empedocles, the 5th-century philosopher-poet. Empedocles had been gifted with such prodigious intellectual powers that he had eventually become convinced he was a god, and had plunged into the boiling lava of Etna to prove it. More important, here Plato also made contact with the followers of Pythagoras, who flourished throughout the Greek colonies of Sicily and southern Italy. Pythagoras's discovery of the relation between number and musical harmony had led him to believe that numbers held the key to understanding the universe. Everything could be explained in terms of number, which existed in an abstract realm beyond the everyday world. This theory had a profound effect on Plato, who came to believe that the ultimate reality was abstract. What began as numbers with Pythagoras was to become forms or pure ideas in Plato's philosophy. The central feature of Plato's philosophy is his theory of ideas, or forms, which he continued to develop all his life. This means that Plato's theory has come down to us in several differing versions, thus providing philosophers with sufficient material to argue over for centuries to come. No philosophical theory can hope to last the pace unless it has room for argument about how it should be interpreted. The best explanation of Plato's theory of ideas is his own, which is not always the case, in philosophy as elsewhere. Unfortunately, Plato's explanation comes in the form of an image, which places it in the realm of literature rather than philosophy. Briefly, Plato explains that most human beings live as if in a dim cave. We are chained, he says, and facing a blank wall, with a fire at our backs. All we see are flickering shadows playing across the cave wall, and this we take to be reality. Only if we learn to turn away from the wall and the shadows, and escape from the cave, can we hope to see the true light of reality. In more philosophical terms, Plato believed that everything we perceive around us, the shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings of everyday experience, is merely appearance. The true reality is the realm of ideas or forms from which this appearance derives. Thus, a particular black horse can be said to derive its appearance from the universal form of a horse and from the ideal of blackness. The physical world we perceive with the senses is in a continual state of change. By contrast, the universal realm of ideas, which is perceived by the mind, is unchanging and eternal. Each form, such as that of roundness, man, color, beauty, and so forth, is like a pattern for the particular objects of the world. But the particular objects are only imperfect, ever-changing copies of these universal ideas. With the rational use of the mind, we can refine our notions of these universal ideas and begin to apprehend them better. In this way, we can approach the ultimate reality of daylight which lies beyond the dim cave of our everyday world. This realm of universal ideas has a hierarchy, leading from lesser forms to more rarefied abstract ideas, the highest of which is the idea of good. when we learn to ignore the world of ever-changing particulars and concentrate on the timeless reality of ideas, our understanding can begin to rise through the hierarchy of ideas to an ultimate mystical apprehension of the ideas of beauty, truth, and ultimately goodness.